Stay warm and save every day. All in the Kroger app.
Get juicy green, red, or black seedless grapes for $1.88 a pound with your card and a digital coupon. Then find low prices on thousands of items like sparkling ice water, Kroger brand chips, and more with your card.
Shop these deals at your local Kroger today. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Wait. Before we start, just want to make sure we're clear here. While this podcast talks about sobriety, mental health, and addiction, it is not meant to replace professional medical advice. Welcome to Sisters in Sobriety.
I'm Kathleen.
And I'm Sonia.
And we're ex-sisters-in-law, brought together in marriage and bonded through our sobriety journey.
Join us as we talk sobriety, addiction, and everything in between. You're in for quite a ride. And our Substack is buzzing with amazing content, from creative mocktail recipes to insightful courses and reflective exercises. There is something for everyone. Don't miss out. It's a great way to add some extra joy and depth to your journey. Check it out. Welcome to Sisters in Sobriety. Today, we're excited to have Carolyn Beidler joining us. And Carolyn is a leader in the fields of recovery, trauma healing, and advocacy with a background in social work and over a decade of experience. She's dedicated her life to helping others navigate the complexities of addiction, trauma, and healing. She's also the founder of Circle of Shares, a platform designed to amplify the voices of women in recovery, and a contributing author to various publications, including Grit and Grace and In the Rooms.
Yes, and her latest book, You Are Not Your Trauma, is a powerful and compassionate guide to understanding the impact of trauma, and it provides practical tools for reclaiming one's life. Her writing, particularly on Substack, is a blend of personal storytelling and professional insights where she shares her journey and empowers others to find hope and healing.
In today's episode, we'll delve into her deep insights on intergenerational and family trauma, the power of radical vulnerability, and we'll also explore the challenging but transformative process of healing and processing grief. Welcome, Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much. It's wonderful to be with you both. I'm really excited for our conversation today. We're going to cover some deep topics, but hopefully have some fun. And yeah, just really looking forward to being here.
Yes, we're so excited you're here. So can you tell us a little bit about your personal journey and what led you to the work you're doing today?
Yeah, I would love to. It's interesting, that question. I think sometimes my mind has a tendency to go back and say, well, it's like the war stories, like, it got so bad and here's how dark it was and here's what that looked like. And I feel like so many of us, even if our stories are different, we share some of those same commonalities of loneliness and struggle, isolation, and not feeling like belonging. I don't necessarily have to go into how bad it got for you all to understand how bad it got. You know, that's one of the things I love about recovery too, is just we can walk into, maybe it's a figurative recovery space, maybe it's turning on this podcast, but we can connect with other people in recovery. Even though our stories, the particulars might be different, there's that common theme and thread of we are human, we've experienced some hard things, and we're trying to heal from that. And so ultimately what has brought me to this point where I've really made a decision, gosh, and this is going to date me. It was at least 10 years ago now. I've been doing social work for almost 2 decades, if you can believe it. I love to make the joke that Zoom, like, filters do wonderful for my skin, although Riversoft isn't as nice as Zoom. So I've been doing social work for a couple decades. But I remember it was around 2013, and I was just a couple months, maybe almost a year in recovery, about 28 years old, and I met a woman named Alex, and I started volunteering in an outpatient treatment center, and there was a group for college-aged folks who are in or seeking recovery, and Alex was there, and we connected. When she really connected with some of the things I had been through, like sexual violence and living in a home where there was, you know, problematic substance use and alcoholism and some things like that, and we just connected, and I remember having the most incredible experiences with her, just like simple times, you know, in a car, driving to a meeting, sitting in the group room, sitting outside. I was smoking cigarettes back then. Sitting outside having a cigarette. I'm not condoning smoking. I love being cigarette-free, Nick Dupree. But just these moments with her. And Alex was beautiful. She was smart. She was going back to school. She wanted to study criminal justice. And she struggled with a substance use issue and ended up going back out one more time and passed away from an overdose. And so when Alex passed away, I was really shaken. I had lived through an overdose as a young person. I had started treatment and really trying to find recovery as a teenager. But back in the early, mid-90s, the recovery scene was a lot different. Recovery wasn't cool. There wasn't mocktail bars, and J-Lo wasn't out talking about how wonderful alcohol-free life is for your skin. There just wasn't this culture of you cannot use substances. And so I had gone through some of that already. And by the time I met Alex, I made the decision when she died that I was going to be all in, all in. I remember praying, and I was like, and I don't know if your listeners connect, with God or a spiritual path, but I hope you keep listening. But I just felt so moved, and I was like praying, I want to spend my life for this. God, I just knew it. And it was a pivotal moment in my life. I had been doing some other types of caregiving too. And it was like, I just had this fire lit under me. And so I would see in the community different things that Alex didn't have. Alex didn't have access to a recovery house for young women, and she really needed that in college. College is really hard, as we all know, to be substance free. And now there's a lot more supports for people like collegiate recovery programs and things like that. But Alex didn't have access to that. So I got involved with the small group of people, and we built a nonprofit recovery home for women. And so I started getting involved in building some of these programs and things. So, and finding my voice, I think as a younger person, I don't qualify, I guess, anymore as a young person in recovery. I'm a middle-aged, nearing perimenopause person in recovery, which is a whole nother topic we should talk about sometime. But I've found my voice in recovery. I found my purpose, losing Alex, and also being so motivated by the stories of young people, all people, families who get well and stay well and find this beautiful path of healing and redemption through recovery. I mean, it's so motivating. I would not want to do anything else. So today I've had a couple things happen in recovery, got married, got pregnant with twins, became a mom, became a wife. Some of these other things were how I can be of service in the community has changed a little bit. But I still have that opportunity. So now today I'm writing books, and I am doing some work for different federal agencies and work with some research, collaborators and different things, all kind of centered on this idea of how can we build up support for people and families, and how can we just get the word out about recovery, because it is such an amazing way of life.
How's your experience with your own addiction influenced your approach to helping others? I find myself pulling from my own experience a lot when I'm talking to people struggling in addiction.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so much. And I think that's another thing that's so beautiful about recovery is we can use those hard times and things that we've learned from to help others. Kind of this sense of paying it forward and giving back because of what we learned. And 100%. I mean, I think my experience of extreme isolation and just this shame that I walked around with for so many years, I was just looking back. I mean, the only word, I'm a writer, so I love words, but I think I try to think about how to describe something. And for me, shame was this heavy coat. It was the heaviest coat, weight that I just had on my, and I just couldn't break free of it. And so I was walking through the world with this heaviness and this heaviness that I couldn't shake. And I don't want that for people. And I see women today, I live in a small town in Eastern Tennessee, and behind the scenes, I always tell people the actual really cool stuff I do, no one will ever see on social media, and I'm not going to be writing about it in books. But I connect with women here in Eastern Tennessee, and you can just see sometimes that heaviness. I mean, even literally watching someone walk, you can see the shoulders turn down, and But to see when the light comes back on in the eyes and that weight starts to lift and people can walk more freely, and you just, it's a beautiful thing to witness. I've felt it, I've experienced it personally, and I see it happen, especially with when I see it with other women. It's just, it keeps me going. It's a beautiful thing.
How do you now maintain your own mental and emotional well-being as a social worker, and like even just writing about addiction and the things that you're writing about trauma, and even the things that you're dealing with behind the scenes? How do you maintain your own mental well-being and emotional well-being?
Yeah, that's such a great question. I would love to hear your thoughts on that too, Kathleen. Yeah. For me, and actually in the book, my next book, that in the end, I love to include like practical things that people can use and through, but I include a series of resilience practices, but things that people, and myself included, and I included them because they are so helpful for me, that as I'm working in recovery. And so in terms of what I do for my own recovery and how I focus on my mental health and well-being, it's really a lot of the same things that I learned early on in recovery. You know, I reach out, I make phone calls when I'm struggling. I go to different types of recovery support. So my pathways for recovery have changed over time. Mm-hmm. But I surround myself with people in recovery, and that is so healing for me. A couple of the other things that I do that today I know that it is related to my recovery, but you know, when I first entered this journey, I would have been like, oh, what are you talking about? But moving my body, going for walks, I mean, that is like one of the huge things. You know, just gentle stretches. I work out, probably not as much as I should, but I'm not talking about exercise for like that side. I'm talking about this for mental well-being, slow walking, movement. I like to, you know, pray when I walk, meditate. So those types of activities that I've learned that really help kind of down-regulate some of when my body is on hyperdrive, which I can still, you know, struggle with some trauma symptoms from time to time. Mm-hmm. So those are a couple of the things that I do. I also love, well, of course, I'm a writer. I love reading. And I find books are such a really cool tool because we can access the wisdom and insight from folks, you know, from ages, right? Like, it is so amazing. So when you find someone who, especially I love reading books by people in recovery, it's like going to a meeting. It's like sitting down and having a cup of coffee where you can hear someone's story and connect with it. And just that feeling of not being alone, you know, is so healing. And it doesn't matter if you have 24 hours in recovery or 24 years, right? We still all benefit from that. So those are a couple things that I do. So when people ask me, you know, it's how many meetings do you go to a week or things like that? Like my recovery looks a lot different today, and it looks a little bit the same. You know, there are some of the same things that I do. I'd say number one is reaching out and surrounding myself with people in recovery.
I was just explaining to a client the other day, her husband struggles with addiction, and you know, that missing link of connection. Like how connection is so important in recovery, and how just pivotal it is. And then one of the other things you said that really resonates with me is moving your body. It is such a non-negotiable for me. Mm-hmm. And even there's moments when life can get hard, right? Life can get hard, and the urge could be to just stay in bed or not move your body. And it's like, just do that one thing.
So Caroline, we're going to switch over to talking about healing from intergenerational and family trauma, which Kathleen and I love talking about in our free time. It's like a recreational activity.
It also comes up, let me just say, in the weirdest of times. Like we could be like shopping at Target and all of a sudden we'll be like, remember this like horrible, like, oh,
we'll make me laugh because it's not funny, but you know, it's nice that we can laugh about it because I totally relate to that a lot. I would love to run into you two at Target and be like, you know, eavesdropping on that conversation because, yes, I totally get that. I totally get that.
And I think we do it too with Kathleen's daughter because we don't want her to think it's like this heavy, serious thing. So sometimes I make jokes about it with her.
More you. That's the auntie role. I'm more like, honey, I'm here to support you through all this. And I'm Sonia's like, more of the jokester.
I'm like, you don't have a dad, I don't have a dad, you know, sucks. But yeah. So what are some common signs? Actually, this is, I probably have them all, that someone is dealing with intergenerational trauma.
Oh, that's a good question. So, you know, just a little bit of context for kind of how we talk about intergenerational trauma in the book. So the book actually was co-written by my mother, Diana. So Diana, also a trained social worker, interestingly enough, I followed in my mom's footsteps, but she has interludes throughout the book. So one of the things that I discovered into my recovery journey early on, probably a year or two in, was how much trauma, specifically my family trauma, what my mom had been through, how I was raised, some of those things, how it was impacting me still, and how I needed to deal with some of those deep-seated issues in order to move forward with my healing. And I think, I was just talking to a friend about this, I think, you know, we may get to a point in our recovery when our mind starts to heal and our brain starts to heal and our body starts to heal where it becomes safe to start looking at some of these other things. And I think a lot of the books and literature and a lot of the stuff out there helps us get into recovery, but it doesn't help us stay. It doesn't help us move to the next level of really digging in and digging in a safe way to start dealing with some of these things. So for me, intergenerational trauma and what my mother experienced, because she talks about in the book, her experiences with unhealthy relationships, heated relationships, multiple marriages, disordered and unhealthy relationship with food. Some of these patterns, she left my dad when my brother was just turning two and I was about three. And so she kind of went off, and my dad and my stepmom and my grandfather ended up raising us for the most part. And we saw her, you know, throughout the years, but it was, she was really having a hard time showing up as a mother and being there. And so her trauma symptoms were just like out of control for so many years. Interestingly, her trauma, and again, I won't get into that story because that's her story to tell, but her trauma is very similar to what I experienced. And so I found myself, series of relationships, you know, thank God I never married any of them, but I had a similar string of unhealthy relationships, you know, toxic relationship with food, trust issues, all of these things, boundary, distorted sense of boundaries, excessive people pleasing. I mean, all of these indicators, it was like Caroline, Diana, and it was just, it was like, oh, I am repeating a lot of what my mother has been through. And the science, I'm a social worker, I'm not a scientist, but I love to research, and I include some research in the book. There's interesting newer research out there that shows when we experience trauma, it can be generations even before. Generations after that have heightened levels of anxiety, depression, all of these things that indicate some type of trauma. So we know this for example, survivors of the Holocaust. There's been research for Indigenous communities, Black individuals and families, you know, folks who have been through really significant kind of historical trauma, like racism. And then we have experiences like my mother and I, where, you know, we have obviously a certain type of trauma that's different from a lot of what the research is out there right now. But I think that's also shifting to open it up to say, this is something that so many of us experience in recovery, and what can we do about it, and how can we address it? And so it was not an easy topic to talk about, but I think looking at both our personal experience, looking at what the research is saying, there's even, I don't know if you all are familiar with this concept of epigenetics.
Oh, yes. I love epigenetics.
Right. It's like, and we talk a little bit about that in the book, that literally our cells and our DNA are changing based on some of the things we experience. And as a mother now, my twins, I have 6-year-old twins, Henrik and Violet. I don't want them to be repeating some of the things that have been in our family likely for generations. I don't want that to happen. And so looking at, okay, what can I do? What can we do practically to move towards healing and to choose healing over repeating some of those patterns?
Absolutely. I think that's super important. I wanted to ask how someone can begin to recognize and acknowledge the impact of family trauma on the recovery journey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I think everyone's on their own path. But my experience, folks that I've worked with and encountered, I think, as I mentioned before, as we get into recovery and maybe start healing, or maybe, you know, it's before, you know, recovery doesn't necessarily have to mean abstinence. Maybe someone is still, you know, using substances, but exploring some of these things. Whatever stage you're at, I think our minds sometimes would be like, okay, like I'm ready to start doing this. Or we may get to a point where we're just so miserable and like we're just living in this muck, in this mess, that we don't want to do it anymore. And that is kind of the point where I got. I was in a really unhealthy relationship and my eating disorder was out of control and it was just like this. I was having panic attacks and I was nearly suicidal. And I just remember like making the choice, and I talk about this in the book, that healing can be a choice.
Yes.
And for so long, I felt like life was just happening to me. I was a trauma survivor. I had been through these things. I was surviving them, but it was everything happening to me. And I separated from the idea that I actually have agency. I have agency and I have control and I have choice. And I don't have to just let life happen to me. I can be an active participant. Certainly things happen to us outside of our control all the time. But I can make a choice in how I respond to that. So I am a huge proponent of the therapy called Seeking Safety. You may be familiar with it. Love it. I love Seeking Safety because, and I talk about this in the book, because it offers practical coping skills and tools with how to cope with our symptoms of trauma and the hard stuff like today, right now. We're not necessarily going back and doing exposure therapy and EMDR, although those things may be very helpful for folks. And I've experienced that as well. But I've found it very helpful to look at the more practical, how do we address what we're feeling now? Mm-hmm. So, for example, with coping skills, when I have anxiety coming up, what are some things that I can do? You know, when I'm acting unhealthy, kind of in those trauma symptoms and not from a place of healing, what I might do is I might reach out, even if I'm not using substances, it might be texting my boyfriend or grabbing the pint of ice cream or some of those other things.
So how does unaddressed family trauma manifest in addiction and recovery?
That's a great question. Well, I really believe that we will start showing signs, or like it'll become clear that something isn't working.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I remember when I was early in recovery and dealing with some changes. I had gone back to graduate school. I ended up leaving a really unhealthy relationship. But what ended up happening was all of these other like symptoms started happening. You know, a lot of mental health challenges. I had severe anxiety, depression. I ended up being diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, which I think a lot of us in recovery it's an underdiagnosis. Because once I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD, I just felt like this. All of a sudden, it clicked. You know, like, wow, I finally started making sense to myself. So, you know, I think there's a lot of different ways that we can learn we need to start addressing more of what has happened to us and who we are if we want to move forward in our recovery. And that includes what we've experienced intergenerationally. There's a lot of really great research out there. I talk a little bit about that in my book. But I would definitely point listeners to some of the research out there that talks about heightened levels of depression, anxiety, and other mental health symptoms as kind of this clear indicator there's something else going on. A lot of times people are like, well, I tried recovery, I tried sobriety, and it was just not for me. I was miserable. And my first thing is always like, well, did you give it at least 90 days? Because you need to at least 90 days for your brain to start healing. But then a year, 2 year in, you see a lot of people going back out 5 years. I believe it's because these things are coming up that we need to address and deal with, and we aren't. We don't have the tools, and we don't have the tools to recognize them.
Sonia and I talk about in one of our early episodes of the podcast the difference between emotional sobriety and physical sobriety. And you can really see that, like, we talk about a little bit in that episode about my ex-husband and her brother who was sober physically for 10 years, but didn't do the work on on his trauma, to be honest, like on all the things that were happening. And so when life got hard, he went back to drinking. And I think that weaves in with that emotional sobriety piece is like, what's the healing you're doing? It's not just about physically not using the substance anymore. It's like, what are you doing to heal?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I love that so much. And I think we can ask ourselves that question. And we can also look towards who we want to be, you know, almost this kind of like this goal setting of, okay, does Caroline want to be the person that still has issues with food, that is in all of these horrible relationships, is promiscuous and does not value herself or her body? Does Caroline want to have, you know, untreated post-traumatic stress? Does Caroline want to keep living like this, even in recovery? Or does Caroline want to be free from this? And what do I really want my life to look like? And I did some work around that. I went back to see a therapist. And what I wanted for my life, wanted to be an author, wanted to be in a relationship with a good man and have a healthy relationship, wanted to be a mother. You know, I wanted to be able to show up in a way for my kids in a more healed way than my mother had shown up for me. I didn't want my kids or my family to live in an alcoholic home. I wanted there to be stability. So I thought about deeply, you know, spent a lot of time thinking about what kind of life do I want to live and who do I want to be? And looking at that and making those decisions, I think sometimes it's really important just to confront that, you know, because it's hard to live in denial when you're like, okay, this is where I want to be, but this is where I still am. And you can make the choice to just stay stuck and stay where you are. But it's a beautiful thing when we can be like, no, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm going to choose healing. I'm going to choose to go in this direction and then find the tools, surround ourselves with people who know a lot more than us, surround ourselves with recovery communities, listen to your podcast, you know, just saturate ourselves with the knowledge and the tools and the skills to be able to move into that next, you know, into that where we want to be.
Did you know your actual age might not be the same as your biological age? That's right. It's not just about your birth date. Your body could be older or younger than you think. That's where True Diagnostic comes in. With their True Age test, you can discover your true biological age, plus get insights into things like your risk for heart disease, Alzheimer's, and even early mortality. And the best part? It's all done from the comfort of your own home. No prescriptions, no lab visits, just a simple test sent right to your door. By tracking your biological age, you can actually see how the changes you make, whether it's to your exercise, diet, or sleep, affect your health over time. It's about taking actionable steps to improve your well-being. Oh, and if you're wondering about high-profile people taking it seriously, Brian Johnson, the guy who's working on reversing aging, and I watched his documentary on Netflix, uses True Diagnostic to track his progress. Ready to find out your biological age? Right now, our listeners can get 20% off their entire order at truediagnostic.com by using the code CIS2025 at checkout. That's True Diagnostic, TRUDIAGNOSTIC.com. Just use the code SIS2025 to save 20%. Plus, if you subscribe, you'll get an additional 20% off the 50% discount. Discover your true age today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Are you looking to reset your relationship with alcohol?
look no further than our self-paced 7-day reset program. In just 1 week, you'll gain the tools and support you need to kickstart your journey to a healthier, more balanced lifestyle. Our program includes daily audio, helpful exercises, and guided reflections. And best of all, it's on your time. Head over to sistersinsobriety.substack.com and let's take that first step together towards a better you. So, Caroline, what initial strategies do you recommend for breaking that cycle of intergenerational trauma? How can somebody start?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think definitely once you notice that there's more going on under the surface and feel moved to seek help, maybe it's because you're at a place of, oh, I'm just so miserable in these kind of symptoms I'm experiencing and this life that I'm living, or, you know, just making the choice that you want something else for your life. I think always, always, always reaching out for external support is 100%. Mm-hmm. Kathleen, you do counseling. Mm-hmm. I'm a huge proponent of therapy.
Yeah.
If you're working in a recovery program, have a sponsor, awesome. I feel like a lot of us still need professional mental health treatment. We've been through some things. And so seeking that outside support, that was the first thing I did once I really started experiencing some hard things and knowing that there was a lot more going on under the surface for me. So seeking out outside professional support, surrounding ourselves with healthy communities. So that I would say recovery community, 100%. And there's other healthy communities out there. Today, I'm a part of a mom's group at one of our local churches. And these ladies are hilarious. We have a lot of fun. No one's in recovery but me. And I love making like recovery jokes. And we were out for dinner the other night. And the waiter came around and was like asking if anyone had allergies. And I felt like, I have an allergy to alcohol and other drugs. And he was like this younger kid. And he was so confused, but everyone like started laughing. But they're my people and they love me and they value me and support me. So finding that. And it may sound, if you're listening and you're like, oh, I don't know, but I don't trust people and I don't have those people. It may sound hard and I've been there too, but those people are out there. And I think the world is so different now today too, where a lot of communities, there's a lot online going on that's really cool. If you're afraid to be in person with people right now, I want to encourage you at some point, it's really important to do that, to be in person. But if you need to start on Zoom, if you need to start in the living room with your pajamas on and like with your camera off on Zoom, like start where you need to start, but surround yourself with other people. And then one of the things in the book that we do, well, five of the things, we have five rhythms that we walk through with practical exercises, journaling exercises, question prompts to help you move through these specific set of rhythms that are created to guide you, move you towards healing. Now, it's not like do these things and you're going to be free of all your troubles, right? It's not like a quick fix, but it's more a tool to be able to use. You can use it with your therapist. I've been hearing a lot of people are actually doing that with early copies, which is really cool. But a tool to be able to guide through some specific ways heal. The first being, I'm not going to give them all away, but we talk a lot about boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
Boundaries being something for my experience being a survivor of trauma, specifically around sexual trauma and sexual violence. My sense of boundaries and sense of self was so distorted for so long. And so I really needed to learn that I had agency, I had choice and control over my body. I can decide who to let in and who to kick out, kind of thing. And learning specific tools around assertive communication, how to communicate directly with people, how to have those conversations and have that period at the end and be like, nope, this is it, and stand up for myself. So working through some of those things as like practical ways to start addressing it.
Yeah, I think, Caroline, that's really important. And you've said the word choice numerous times and agency, and it's actually what is the foundation for how I live my life and how I practice psychotherapy. Because I think that even in the most dire circumstances, there can be choice. There can, even if it's I choose how I am seeing this or I'm choosing what my thoughts are. There can be choice. And I think that you've mentioned that numerous times, like in terms of healing, like there is a choice to heal. I think you said healing is a choice. I feel like that needs to be a bumper sticker or something.
I love that so much. And yeah, I do use the word choice a lot. And I think it's important too, as we're having these conversations, to ground down into this idea that we have agency and we're able to make decisions and have choice. I love that you incorporate that in your practice. And I think anytime we're having conversations about trauma, it's really important to stay grounded in that truth. And as I mentioned, you know, at the end of my new book, I have a set of resilience practices, grounding actually being a really helpful thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes as we're doing some of this work, things may come up. My mom jokes, she's like, I wonder if the book actually needs like a trigger warning. I'm like, yeah, that's a really good point. And it has trigger warnings throughout, actually, because as we're talking about this, even though we don't talk super explicitly about different things, maybe a little bit, a lot of our own stuff starts coming up, and that's part of the process of it. But we need to have these moments, these interrupted moments where we can say, we can practice some grounding, remind us we are present. We are here right now. We don't have to let our minds wander back into that place. I know I'm kind of getting into the weeds a little bit. But anyways, I think it's important to keep at the forefront of our minds this idea of choice around healing, especially when we are coming from a place of needing to heal from trauma.
What about forgiveness? Is forgiveness a choice, and does it have a role in healing from trauma?
That may be one of the rhythms. Yes, 100%. And it's really hard.
That was a really hard section to write about.
And it's a really hard thing to talk about. I think there's this idea of like we may be able to forgive or get to a place of forgiveness, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you'll forget. That doesn't necessarily mean that if someone did you harm, that it's going to be open arms to that person and they're going to be coming to holiday dinner.
Mm-hmm.
Like we may need to set up some boundaries. So forgiveness it's a really complex thing, but it can be so freeing when we get to that place. You know, my mom and I's relationship, I mean, the fact that we could write this book together, I'm just so honored. How it actually came to be was because we've done a lot of work on forgiveness, you know? I mean, she took off when I was a kid, and there's a lot that I could hold resentment for. And there's probably family members that have some of that resentment, but you can see the difference between living with a heart of forgiveness and living in that place of bitterness. And it's just, it's like light, night and day, you know? And
yeah.
I don't want to be in that place. Have I forgotten everything?
No.
But mom and I can do things like write a book together. And, you know, she's like my best friend, and she's been my best friend for a really long time. So, yeah, I love that you brought that up. So we are thinking alike there. If we take that a step further, how important is it to involve family members in the recovery process when you're dealing with family trauma?
Sometimes I find, like for me, I would get like re-traumatized by the same people who caused the trauma. But is it important to force myself to do that?
You know, I think that's a really good question to ask. If you have a therapist and you're asking that question, then maybe bring that to your session. Okay, cool. That's awesome. Because I think everyone is different and every situation is different, where it actually may cause more harm to yourself or to the other person to like actively involve them, having them physically present. My father actually passed away about a year ago. And interestingly, I feel like I have done so much work on growing up in an alcoholic home since he passed away. He has not been physically present for that.
I feel like there's like some like mysterious, maybe he's been spiritually present for that. But when he was living, he would not have been able to participate in like a family session or like that type of healing with that. But for me, I have still been able to do work around forgiveness and healing that part of my family trauma with him in a sense, but also not with him. That's just a different example. So I think it really, really depends on the situation. And it's important to be mindful about how those choices are made and bringing in people who, like Kathleen, have that experience and maybe from that a mental health professional therapeutic side who can kind of help us make those decisions.
I know, especially early on for me. Oh my gosh. I had a woman who was mentoring me early on in recovery. She was a sponsor. And I had gone through, I thought I'd gone through the steps myself and I was going to make amends to this my ex-boyfriend. And I mean, she was just like, she sat me down and she's like, oh my gosh, you really need to do this with someone else. You know, you really need to walk through this with help. You can't do this by yourself. So being able to, even with that, the family dynamics, bringing other people into that, we don't ever have to do healing alone, ever, which is really freeing. It's really cool. We never have to make those choices. So when it comes to those really tough family relationships and traumatizing things, we do not have to make those decisions about how to heal. We don't have to do the work. We can do that in community with others and with professional support.
What are some of the therapeutic approaches that you think are effective in addressing intergenerational trauma?
Mm-hmm. Well, in the book, I do kind of an overview of some of the evidence-based modalities that there are, EMDR and you know, some of the other types of work, cognitive behavioral therapy. I've been trained as a mental health provider, but I'm not practicing. And so I'm very clear about where I come from, an experience of personal experience and with a background in social work, working with women in recovery, using storytelling to do that. But then that distinction between I'm not a practicing mental health provider right now, so I'm not going to advocate for one type of evidence-based treatment over there. Although I do in my book talk about kind of this overview of different options and then also share a little bit about how seeking safety was helpful for me. You know, I can speak from my personal experience and the gaps that I see in how we're approaching treatment and recovery, specifically with women who've experienced trauma. And I think we're missing, and that's part of why I wanted to write the book, I think we're missing those practical ways that people can cope with stress, cope with these symptoms, and like live our active daily lives in a quality way. And so the very simple things that we talked about this earlier, moving our bodies, what a concept, like get off the couch, put your phone down, go for a walk outside. I mean, this is gonna, it's amazing and it's gonna do wonders. Work on grounding and staying present, learning how when we're really regulated to be able to downregulate and do some of these, not simple, but these tools that are very practical. So I feel like we were able to help kind of self-soothe and cope with some of these stressors, that we can move on to do some of the harder work, maybe seeing a therapist, maybe starting to do EMDR. But then we have the tools to be able to do some of this other type of stuff. So I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, it does. It really answers my question. And it's interesting because as, you know, as a psychotherapist, I see clients every day, obviously, and what I have found is that there's a lot of talk therapy that doesn't actually give people tools. And so I usually start with the tools with my clients, even couples. So I start with tools. Like, how do you emotionally regulate? How do you regulate those feelings, not to get rid of them, but how do you let them move up and out or through you? Which I think we're just not taught that. People aren't taught that generally. And so in order to do the deeper work, then those tools can be really effective safety net in many cases.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that so much. And with the tools piece too, you know, I remember, and you're probably familiar with acceptance and commitment therapy.
That's my main modality.
It's her thing. Okay. We are on those same ones. I love acceptance and commitment therapy. I when I was doing my training, I worked at the VA hospital and learned facilitating acceptance and commitment therapy while also simultaneously like going through the process. And when I learned that I didn't have to attach to thoughts that I was having, that actually my thought life wasn't like there to control me. It didn't have to have control over my life. It was groundbreaking for me. So how can we bring some of these tools into the recovery community? I think, and that's part of what I feel so called and moved to do, because they are so transformational. More people need access to this.
I totally agree, obviously. We're so singing from the same book.
Sure. Carolyn, I wanted to shift to the concept of radical vulnerability. Is that
one of the tools? And what is radical vulnerability? What does it mean to you? And why is it so important in recovery?
Yeah. Well, I love the concept of radical vulnerability. And it's not trademarked or anything. Brené Brown probably used the first for someone else. One of the rhythms is centered on that, but it's not specifically. It's about getting honest and it's about being real. So when we can just come fully, become present and kind of show up as ourselves, and that might be like telling our, airing the dirty laundry, getting it all out in a safe way, or just showing up and being honest with another person about where we're at and what we're feeling. Again, transformational. And I think that's one of the reasons, and there has been some research on this, but like why 12-step fellowships and that model for recovery support has been so beneficial and obviously is working for so many people. Now, again, I'm a huge believer in a lot of different pathways. So I'm not advocating one or the other here. But just that idea of showing up and sharing what's going on with us, how novel. But like we're taught, and a lot of us are taught to put on our Sunday best, keep it all in. We have it all together, especially if you're like me, like in your 40s and stuff. I feel like it's changed a little bit for the younger generations where it's more accepted to share where you're at and talk about mental health and these different things. That it's shifting and slowly shifting. But I think for a lot of us, we're just taught to like have it all together. And I wish like everyone operated like a recovery meeting, like all the time. I hate small talk. My kids started soccer and I'm like, oh no, here it goes. It begins. I'm now a soccer mom in recovery. But like I detest small talk because I just want to get to the deep stuff. So what's really going on with you? I don't want to talk about what you got at Target or like, this, that. I want to know like, what family trauma are you working on? I think that would be a little bit maybe too much for the sideline soccer game with the soccer mom. But really, though, how can we say, you know what? I'm not having a good day. And here's what happened. My husband and I aren't getting, and just like being able to be honest about what's going on is so, it sounds so like simple almost, like just be honest and share what's going on with you. But it's hard to do. It's really hard to do, I think, especially when we're conditioned to have it all together. And, I think especially as women, we got to balance all the things and the mom and the house and the this and the that and also look nice. And like, it's just like tiring. Anyways.
No, that really resonates with me actually, like in many ways, because I struggle with that. I struggle, and Sonia knows this, of like, looks like everything is put together, but if you scratch just below the surface and you really ask me how I am, like, then the truth comes out. And so it is, I think it's conditioned in us in many ways. It's a cultural, like the society we live in. I think it is changing, thank goodness. But I think it's a great reminder just to how can you bring radical vulnerability into your day-to-day life? And so how can someone bring that into their everyday life, especially in recovery? Is that like someone asks you how you are and you actually say how you are?
I think that's a really good place to start.
Yeah.
I have a friend. She's so funny. We all have those friends that challenge us a little bit. She's one of those people for me. But she'll be like, oh, hey, how's it going? And I'm like, oh, it's good. Things are okay. And she'll look at me and give me like the death stare and stare into my soul and like just drill right in there. And she's like, no, how is your heart? And I'm like, don't ask me that because it's not good today. Or maybe it is good. But having those people, and I feel like I'm kind of a broken record because it is so self-important. If we need those people in our lives that we can have those conversations with, And I'm not saying, and so Caroline, what challenges do people typically face when they're trying to be vulnerable, especially in the context of addiction?
I think trust is something that can take a long time to build back, and not just trust with specific individuals that may have caused us harm, but trust in general for other human beings, especially when we've experienced a lot of adverse, childhood experiences and different things where the people in our lives who are supposed to be supportive and trustworthy and all of these things, stable, are not, it can really rock our sense of just anyone in general being trustworthy. And so I think that was something that I struggled with for a very long time. And being able to work through some of that, it did take time, and it took other people in my life kind of showing up in a way that showed me, that not everyone's all bad, right? Mm-hmm. I don't
keep hiding from the world because not everyone is out to hurt me. And sometimes that takes time to learn. I wish there was like an easy solution and an easy answer for that. Sometimes it just takes time. But I do know that for me, being in recovery helped that process go a lot more quickly. Because when I was using substances, I was not opening myself authentically to be able to learn how to trust and to see other people as trustworthy. I was still isolating, even around people. I had this insulation of, I was totally isolated and desensitized from connecting with another person. So
I think there's often a fear of judgment, not just in recovery. Like I just, you know, I think that happens a lot. I even see like through social media, which can be evil and good, but you know, that comparison or the judgment being fear of being canceled or judged. Are there any practical steps that you think can help overcome that fear of being judged when someone is radically vulnerable?
I think this falls a lot on kind of the community around us. And it's part of why I do a lot of my writing around this idea of judgment, grace, kind of how do we work through some of the stigmatizing feelings that we have. I actually wrote an article recently and it's called I'm Not Like You and Other Lies We Tell Ourselves. And interestingly, people really responded to it because I think that this idea of like we are not like each other keeps us so separate. You know, I can say, oh, you over there with the addiction issue, you have your thing over here. I'm not like this, but we are so alike. Doesn't matter what our thing is. I truly believe that we're all in recovery from something. And so whether that thing is substances, alcohol, other drugs, social media,
food,
exactly. Relationships, like whatever our thing is, we're all in recovery. So when we can start breaking down those barriers, but I believe it really is a call to action to the community to do, like, we all need to do our own work so we can get to a place where these walls start coming down and we see each other for who we are, which is we're human. We're all dealing with our own stuff. You know, we have no right to judge or look down on anyone else because we all have our own stuff going on. And when we're radically honest and vulnerable, we realize that. We realize that how much more alike we are than different.
I love that. And I think that kind of lack of judgment, what does that have to do with self-compassion to you? And what role does self-compassion play in radical vulnerability?
Well, I remember when I first came back from addiction treatment. I was 17 and came back from inpatient treatment and I was ready to be on this recovery journey. I was super excited. I had met other younger people in recovery, you know, who were trying to get sober. And so I came back to the high school where I got sick in, where I started my substance use disorder. And I remember that first day walking back, you know, I had finally done my hair again and I had, you know, had my backpack on. I was walking down the hall and I'll never forget, I started hearing the calls of people saying loser, you know, crackhead, addict, and walking down this hall and hearing these echoes. And it was like immediately I was just shot down, like that shame, that heavy coat that I was talking about, I put that right back on. Instantly. And so having that experience of what it was like to feel that stigma and feel that judgment just reinforces. And today I can still just put myself back in that hallway, that high school hallway, but reinforces just how needed the reverse is grace. You know, if someone would have come up alongside me and said, I'm really proud of you. You know, you look like, you're ready to do something different. Recovery is actually a real thing that people can do and you can live a different life. Someone to come alongside us and say that and believe it to be true versus this stigmatizing place, this box that we can get put into as a quote unquote addict or alcoholic. It could just be so transformational. And later in life, I would have that. I've had people come alongside me to say those things. And most importantly, I've had the example of other women in recovery, specifically for me, older women, who have shown me like, wow, that life is possible and have shown me the reverse and have allowed me to take that coat off and never put it back on again. Like, and I've written about some really, like, talking about radical vulnerability, I'm pointing to my book here for your listeners. I talk about some really gritty stuff in there and things that I've done I'm not proud of. And my mom and I were laughing. It's like,
I cannot believe my neighbors are going to read things. Yeah. Like, oh my goodness. But I'm saying that stuff and I'm being honest and I'm being radically vulnerable and I'm not putting on that coat. I don't have to have shame over the things that I've done, what's been done to me, the places I've gone. I don't have to live in that place. I can live free and I can give myself grace today. In part because of how I've seen other women walk with that grace.
Thank you. I think that's a beautiful place to end today. And I just really thank you so much for all the wisdom you shared with us today. You can pick up Caroline's new book, You Are Not Your Trauma. Where can you pick that up, Caroline?
Anywhere books are sold.
Wonderful. And thank you so much, everyone, for listening to Sisters in Sobriety. And we'll see you next week.
This was Sisters in Sobriety.
Thank you for listening and being with us today.
If you want to learn more about sobriety and meet your community, find us at sistersinsobriety.substack.com.
Are you a sister in sobriety? Then reach out on social media. We'd love to hear from you.
If you're feeling generous, leave us 5 stars and a review and follow us wherever you listen.
You'll never miss an episode. Until next time.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.